I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Joining us now, former Wisconsin U.S. Senator Russ Feingold. Russ, welcome to the show.
Good to be on the show. Thanks.
All right, so Legit Action. Tell people a little bit about Legit Action if they have not heard this group that you started.
Well, after the 2016 election in November and December, I had some time on my hands, and I started thinking about what was really happening in this country, not just in terms of Donald Trump being elected, as terrible as that was, but, you know, what else is really happening at the same time? And I realized that there's going to be tremendous focus on Trump himself, which you really can't help, but at the same time, there are all kinds of forces in this country that are going after the basic institutions of our democracy, our legitimacy, and they were doing it before Trump, and they'll be doing it after Trump, including the people like the Koch brothers and Scott Walker and others going after people's right to vote, the obvious harm to the campaign finance system, the foolishness of having an electoral college that doesn't make sense anymore, and, you know, basically the theft of the Supreme Court, which every day now, as we're getting to the end of the Supreme Court term, we see the result of the completely illegitimate taking of Barack Obama's appointment to the Supreme Court and giving it to Donald Trump. So what the group is about saying, look, these are the foundations of our democracy, and we have to defend them independently of worrying about what Donald Trump's going to do next.
In a time period where things are very tribal and polarized, how do you get people to think beyond their immediate self-interest when, you know, something may be unjust and it's helping one side or another? And this may not always necessarily be something that helps conservatives. There may be situations, well, gerrymandering in Illinois would be a great example. That's just as wrong as gerrymandering in Wisconsin. But how do you get people to kind of look beyond their immediate self-interest?
Very difficult because people seem to be in a place right now where they are looking very narrowly at what's exactly good for them, and that sense of community that, you know, you and I sort of grew up being taught to respect and understand seems to be in a very weak state. There's a sort of separation of people into different groups and not worrying about your fellow person and the different communities that make up Wisconsin or the entire country. And so it's very hard to do. And the best thing you can do, I think, is to point out that when people were fair and used fair practices with each other, treating somebody the way you'd expect to be treated in the reverse situation, that it really ended up being a less angry and a better society. But that's a hard argument to make. People have to learn history. And unfortunately, they're going to have to see the consequences of this awful approach that Donald Trump is leading in this country and that the right is using to implement the agenda of the billionaires and the very wealthy interests that really control our democracy now. We do not have the type of democracy that we used to have.
Was the behavior of both sides during the ultimate Supreme Court decision of Bush v. Gore in the 2000 election a pretty good example where people were not fighting for fairness, people were fighting to win at all costs?
It was an example of that in some ways, and of course I'm a little biased, but I think there's no question it was much more so on the Republican side and on the Republican-controlled Supreme Court. That was an awful decision. And the reality is that Al Gore stepped aside. He did not use a blood and guts, everything for me, and whatever lever I can possibly do. He did not do that. And so he was an example there of the way things could be, the way things used to be, which is, you don't win at all costs. You don't try to win at all costs. That there are limits. So it was a bad incident, but Al Gore certainly showed character and a concern for all Americans by not prolonging that.
And, of course, leading up to that election, we saw cases of voter suppression, which is obviously something you're concerned about. Let me ask you about the electoral vote, because I never thought two times in my lifetime we'd have a situation where the person that lost the popular vote in this last election by a pretty wide margin would end up being president of the United States. What's the solution for this?
Well, I didn't think it would happen either. In fact, when I was in high school, I was at a debate institute in Eau Claire, and we had to write papers, and I thought it was kind of funny that there was this electoral college, and they actually made a decision in the other way in 1876 in the Tilden Hayes election. And so I never thought it would happen, and now what you have is two people who really, in many ways, should never have been president, somehow become president, and frankly, in both cases, Bush to a great degree, but Trump to an even greater degree, they diminished the seriousness with which the rest of the world treats the United States or thinks of the United States. So, you know, obviously a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College would do the job, but that's very hard to do. Another way it can be done, I believe, and I've been working on this, is an interstate compact where a group of states each agree that they will put all their electoral votes behind whoever wins the national popular vote. And actually, there are quite a number of states that have agreed to enter into this so-called National Popular Vote Compact. You only need 270 total electoral votes out of those states, and there are already over 170. We just added Connecticut to the list. So it is conceivable that for the 2020 election, this compact, interstate compact, could be put into place. It doesn't require amending the Constitution. I don't think it would be considered unconstitutional. So a lot of people don't realize, but that really could happen. And we are working with Legit Action and other groups to organize, now that we've won in Connecticut, in other states like Oregon. And frankly, if we have a good result in Wisconsin and a few other states, we could maybe add a state like Wisconsin.
It would really take a Wisconsin.
We don't have it here.
It would really take a Wisconsin and an Ohio and, you know, maybe a state like Colorado to put this thing over the top. Wouldn't it take some swing states, not states that lean strongly one way or another?
Well, yeah, there are a couple of states that don't. Of course, Wisconsin is a state that would add to it. There would be more purple states that would add to this. But, you know, this is actually passed in Republican houses in Arizona, and one of the houses was Republican and voted for it. In Connecticut, where we just had our first victory in a number of years on this issue, the state Senate was tied, and we end up winning on this vote 20-10. So it is not automatically a partisan issue. It's going to be easier probably in Democrat or mixed states, but it, you know, it's within reach. All you need is a few states.
The whole notion of the Electoral College, what's some misnomers people have about the Electoral College, why it was set up, and its failings?
Well, I think people think it's some aspect of a divine inspiration of the U.S. Constitution, when in fact it's a mess, and it was a mess from the beginning. If you read, as I've done, the debate in the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787-1788, they really were having a hard time with this. Some people wanted the president, chosen by the House. Others wanted it by popular vote, and they had to come up with a compromise that would keep the slave states and others on board and the small states not be too worried. So they came up with this thing, but it was so screwed up that they had to actually amend the Constitution just two amendments after the Bill of Rights in 1803. The 12th Amendment had to be put into place to change the Electoral College right away because the original mess didn't work. Some of the constitutional scholars have said the founders misfired on this. And what happened was, the way it was set up is that they voted for two people, and so when people voted for Jefferson and Aaron Burr, one for president, one for vice president in theory, they were actually tied. And so when this went to the House of Representatives to be decided, if one guy had figured out a way to vote for Burr instead of Jefferson, Burr would have become president, even though everybody intended Jefferson would be. So they changed it. And the truth is, this system benefited the slave states and benefited those who benefited from the three-fifths man vote. In other words, they would get more electoral votes even though they were slaves, even though they couldn't do anything other than be basically treated like farm animals. They helped those states get more electoral votes. So in many ways, this is a system born in slavery. And the final thing that's so important is, even all that, putting all that aside, there never was any assumption that states would have a winner-take-all system, which almost all states have. And so what that does is it makes it even worse, and I think some people actually believe that it's unconstitutional to say that all the people that vote for the other presidential candidate in that state get absolutely no electoral votes. So getting rid of the sort of winner-take-all aspect of this is the most important way to make sure that it gets reformed.
Shouldn't we see Democrats campaigning in Texas and Oklahoma and Utah and Republicans campaigning in New York and Connecticut and Vermont?
Yeah, one of the things that people say is, oh, the only candidates will only campaign in the big states, and they won't spend any time anywhere else. Well, actually, that's what happens now. Is all they do is campaign in a few key swing states, and you know, just like candidates don't go to California or New York that much, they also never go to Kansas or Wyoming. So the truth is, the little states get ignored as well as certain big states. And if you cause, through this system, everybody's vote to count, which is the result of this, every single person's vote counts. It's not like living in New York where it doesn't matter how you vote for president. This actually could cause candidates to have a much more national campaign rather than going to Monroe, Wisconsin six times, which, you know, I like that. Bush and Kerry were like knocking into each other around Baumgartner's over there in Monroe. But, you know, this
and, is. And Baumgartner's is a very good restaurant.
Well, if you're going to get knocked into people, that would be the place. Yeah.
And the Electoral College, when it's gone against the will of the American individual voter, we've had some pretty, as you pointed out, devastating consequences. And it seems to me the compromise and some of the shenanigans that went on in that race between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden? I can't remember his first name.
Samuel Tilden,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It was basically gave the South the ability to repress black people again, to institute the Jim Crow laws and all the other racist things. That was part of the deal.
Yeah, so ultimately the Northerner got the presidency, but the Southerners got to keep the power and the repression.
Got to repress people for another 100 years, and now they're up to it again.
Do you get the feeling people are becoming animated about this? I know that people have become very animated about, you know, the fair maps and gerrymandering, very much so. Do you think they've gotten animated about this Electoral College?
I think almost everybody thinks it's ridiculous, but what they don't realize, and they get excited when they find it out, ran a successful campaign in Connecticut where people had no idea what was going on. When they found out they could do something like this, it caught fire pretty soon. So what I'm hoping is that we can get at least one house of the state legislature here in Wisconsin and get the governorship and immediately start an effort to add Wisconsin to the list. I think once people realize this and see that most scholars don't think it would be struck down as unconstitutional, I think it could create a lot of enthusiasm. But no, people don't know about it. I didn't know about it until a couple of years ago. It was invented as an idea after the 2000 election because people were trying to think of how could we change this thing without having to pass a constitutional amendment.
And what does legit action do in these? You know, how did you campaign in Connecticut?
Well, we found out that there was a great group organizing in Connecticut, and there hadn't been a new state added to the list for several years. And we got a hold of a guy named Jonathan Perlow, who was just a voluntary organizer of this. And I was going to be teaching and was teaching last year at Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. And we heard they were going to have a rally in the green there, the old green in New Haven. So we sent out emails to people in the area on our list and got them to come to that. And then when I got there, I started making appearances, working with the group, making appearances in a couple different places to try to explain how this could work, and we even had some of the legislators come in and speak. So, we helped with the organizing and motivating people on this, both within Connecticut, but also making people nationally aware of how significant it was that Connecticut became the first state in several years to join the compact.
So, if you're a member of Legit Action, you get updates on this, and you can kind of
that's right.
You can kind of stay involved with this.
Every step of the way.
All right. We'll talk more with former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold here at SlysOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who's going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Jeff's Guitar Clinic is a multifaceted shop offering guitars, amplifiers, and all accessories, guitar lessons for all ages, and instrument repair of the highest quality. Take the scenic drive to beautiful Fort Atkinson and see what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call Jeff's Guitar Clinic today at 920-723-1733. That's Jeff's Guitar Clinic at 920-723-1733. Jeffsguitar.com.
We're back at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers, Madison Firefighters Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and our friends from the Teamsters, Local 695. All right, Senator, as we talk about some of the stuff that's going on, something that didn't get much attention was the Supreme Court decision with Neil Gorsuch as the deciding vote that upheld these binding arbitration contracts in employment law. And, of course, this part of the law was never really written for workers originally. It was kind of business to business, but they're being applied to workers. New York Times, I don't always agree with the New York Times, but they had a great editorial on this. They said 2% of American workers were held to these binding arbitration agreements in 1992. It's now up over 50% of American workers have to sign some sort of binding arbitration agreement when they get a job. Your thoughts on that ruling?
Well, this is a terrible decision. And it was one of the issues that I was trying very hard to work on when I was in the Senate, because I noticed way back in the early 1990s that this thing was starting to grow as a practice. The key here is mandatory binding arbitration. In other words, I have no objection if people are told you have the option to go into this binding arbitration as long as it isn't mandatory for employment or for getting a contract with a business. But they almost always are. So what the court did was uphold a mandatory arbitration. So, you know, a lot of times the arguments that are used by the court and others say, well, you know, it's good to not have to go to court and have to go through all that procedure. Yeah, if you want to. But the problem is it is used, and this is what's particularly outrageous about this decision, it's used when somebody's coming into a new job. Somebody has to sign an agreement saying, look, if I feel I was sexually harassed or the victim of racial discrimination, I have to sign an agreement to go to some arbitrator who's often a bunch of people that are more controlled by the management than the workers. I have to agree to give up my basic rights as a human being in order to get this job. And to me, this is incredibly offensive. I was able, when I was in the Senate, to get some of these individual ones struck down. Passed a bill with a lot of Republicans to prohibit mandatory arbitration agreements against car dealers by the big car companies. They were saying, look, if you want to be a car dealer, you got to sign this thing, and you can't go to court if you think we're doing something wrong to you. And we got that thing passed because, as you know, a lot of Republicans want to be good to their car dealers in their small towns. But what I believe, and I think many others, people in this, believe this is one of the most important worker and consumer issues around, is that this should be prohibited across the board, that there shouldn't be anyone's in, as you say, the sort of unequal relationships. It's different if it's two businesses, as you say, but are two equal sort of businesses. But when you come to consumers, you know, you open up your MasterCard, your Visa thing, and out spills like 800 documents. Well, somewhere in there is a mandatory arbitration thing that you're agreeing to just by opening it up. This is completely unfair, and, you know, it's an example of reason why Legit Action is so fired up about what happened with the Supreme Court. This is entirely because of the theft of the Supreme Court seat. It would have been 5-4 the other way with any reasonable justice, like somebody like Merrick Garland. And so this is one of the greatest thefts in American history, and every day we are feeling the consequences of it, whether it be the travel ban decision, reapportionment, mandatory arbitration. We are veering sharply to the right because of this theft. And that theft occurred before Donald Trump. It was done by the Republicans and the right in this country for the big moneyed interests.
So how do we prevent what happened to Merrick Garland ever from happening again?
this is such a tough nut to crack, but we have to play some form of hardball on this. Hopefully we can get the Senate back and send a message to Trump that he will not get any Supreme Court nominees unless some kind of an arrangement is made to make up for the crime that was committed previously, some kind of a package deal.
And you're calling it a crime?
Well, to me, it's a crime against our Constitution, not literally a crime, but it's a crime against what is undoubtedly our Constitution requirement, which is that if somebody has an opening for a Supreme Court position, the Senate is not allowed to simply ignore the president's appointment and not do anything, that they have an obligation to advise and consent or to not advise and consent, but to do nothing is illegitimate. So somehow the Democrats have to signal that and play hardball without doing exactly what they did, which was wrong.
The consequences of Citizens United. I look at Wisconsin right now, and not just to pick on Kevin Nicholson, but it is pretty interesting. He's leading in the polls when, in fact, he doesn't have a grassroots campaign going. He had people from out of state collect his signatures. And a couple families are, he's not running, his own ads. A couple families are essentially determining who the leader in the Republican Party in the Senate primary is. What do you think of that?
Well, it's not his own family.
That is correct. Touche.
It's unbelievable that this has happened. And of course, that's why one of the pillars of our Legit Action work is what was happened when the Supreme Court basically gutted our campaign finance system by allowing unlimited so-called independent contributions by corporations and invited very wealthy people to do this sort of thing in a way that they had not done in the past. So, it makes a mockery of the individual limits. There is a phony claim that somehow this is independent expenditures, but of course it really isn't. It's
well, they're using his voice. They're using his voice in their commercials.
Yeah, it's such a fraud. And the Congress and the president could pass a law putting teeth into this to make it so you couldn't do this kind of coordination, but it doesn't exist. And there isn't even disclosure. The Supreme Court and Citizens United assumed all the justices except Clarence Thomas said, well, we assume that there'll be a law requiring disclosure of all this activity. Well, of course, the Republicans, who are controlled by the big moneyed interests and the big individual givers, refuse to do that. And so what you have here is a complete mockery. It's not some kind of a legitimate free speech system.
Finally, in an age where there's a lot of hostility and a lot of bad stuff's happened this week when it comes to civility, in the age of Trump, a lot of people are saying, okay, Democrats need to stop talking about Trump so much. He takes a lot of oxygen out of our talking about other things. What is the appropriate way to deal with a president that is behaving erratically and, in some cases, unconstitutionally?
Well, this isn't easy to do, but it's exactly the reason that I decided to found Legit Action. I felt that people were becoming completely wound up with Trump, which is almost impossible not to do, and that he changes the subject every 2 minutes, so you can't get any focus. So what I was trying to do is say, look, we've got to put a focus on those things that are going to happen, whether Trump's around or not. Fight what he does, but don't let the Republicans pull the stunt they did with the tax cuts, where they basically used him as a cover to put through something that never would have gotten through so easily under normal circumstances. So look, you got to do both. You got to walk and chew gum at the same time. And that means not just thinking about Trump, not getting trapped into watching the news and getting all upset about him, and not seeing what they're really doing to us more long term.
And these are cataclysmic decisions being made right now. We're waiting for the Janus decision on unions and their right to organize and people and having to pay dues, that sort of thing.
That's right, and it'll be before in the next few days, yeah.
And workers have been taking it on the chin for quite a while.
And the workers are getting pounded in these decisions, pounded. That mandatory arbitration decision was terrible. This one will probably be very extremely bad. After decades and decades of hard work to get some basic protections in place for workers, this court is clearly hostile toward the working people of this country. and it really is not fair that these justices, at the least in the case of Gorsuch, are sitting there. The Constitution really dictated otherwise.
Can you be optimistic and scared at the same time right now? Because that's kind of how I feel. I see young people like Caleb Frostman come along and Patty Shatner.
Yeah, I mean,
see,
you know,
really interesting people come along that gives me optimism. And there are some days I wake up in the morning and I'm frightened.
Well, I would agree with that. And, you know, I guess one thing I've always said about Democrats and progressives is I'm not sure we're always ready to win. I think we sort of absorb our losses and deal with them, even though this one's just the worst imaginable. But we do have to consider the possibility that things will turn our way and capitalize on it. So just like with dealing with Trump and then with the far right, you got to do both at the same time. You have to be aware of the genuinely scary aspects of what's going on and be concerned, even be a little afraid. But at the same time, you have to have the energy and the patience and the discipline to take advantage of victories. For example, if we're able to get the state Senate back here in the state of Wisconsin, that opens the door to a lot of possibilities, not to mention if we're able to get a new governor.
And then hold people that get elected that are Democrats responsible. You know, rather than this cult of personality, I worry sometimes people begin to look the other way when their side gets elected and they don't hold them responsible for the things they campaigned on.
Right. You can't be sort of just taken with the moment and winning as opposed and defeating the other guy. That's not what this is really about, because somebody's always going to be in that office. It's about the actual results in terms of what's being done to people all over this country, particularly the average citizen, and obviously others such as immigrants, the cruelty of the policies. We have to keep our eye on the ball.
All right. If people want to get involved and join Legit Action, how do they do it?
LegitAction.com. Call us or contact us.
Sounds great. Senator Feingold, thanks for joining us today at SliceOffice.com.
Thank you.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.